Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Last week, as we've been working our way through the Lord's Prayer, we're actually working our way through the book of Luke, and we bumped into Jesus providing his apostles with what we're calling the model prayer as opposed to the Lord's Prayer. And we got as far last week as "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And we looked at all the Old Testament, or at least a handful of Old Testament predictions, prophecies of a kingdom to come, so that we could get the first century mindset of what his apostles would have been expecting when he used the word kingdom, or the language of kingdom. But I didn't show you the fulfillment of all those prophecies, the fulfillment, the final kingdom to come to planet Earth, because there just wasn't time to finish up last week. So this morning we're going to take about 10-15 minutes to talk about the fulfillment of that. Go to Revelation 21, and then we will move on into what I promised you, which is our daily bread. We'll move on from there. So we're starting in Revelation 21, just to look at the fulfillment of "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This is a firm promise all the way through the Old Testament and the Old Covenant that there was a kingdom coming, the reestablishment of Judah and Israel, the two kingdoms combined one more time, all 12 tribes, the setting up of Ezekiel's temple, the regathering of Israel, the light of the Gentiles, Judah finally looking on him whom they have pierced, weeping as one weeps over their only child, recognizing their Messiah who comes and sets up the stone kingdom that will never be defeated, never be crushed, will last forever, as Jeff just read out of Hebrews 1, a kingdom that will come and his scepter will be righteousness. So Revelation 21 tells us very specifically about that kingdom finally coming to earth. And it says, starting at verse 1, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea." Now let me be specific here. Heaven in that verse is not talking about the heaven where God's throne is. In the Bible, you kind of read about separate heavens, and that same word is used in all three instances. It's why Paul would say that he knew such a one as went to the third heaven. Well, that would be the heaven where the throne of God is, but the birds are described as also flying in the heavens. Those birds obviously aren't making it all the way to the throne of God. The atmosphere, the area where the birds fly, that's called heaven, the heavens, looking up, the heavens. Then there's where the stars abide, and you read throughout the Bible that the stars are in the heavens. But that's not the heaven where the throne of God abides. And then we read of heaven where God's throne is. Three different territories, all called heaven. When you read of a new heaven and a new earth here, it is talking about a new atmosphere and a new earth. It is not saying that heaven where God sits needs to be remade or reformed. He sits in perfect light. He sits in purity and holiness. It says that even the stars are not pure in his sight and they flee away from him. There's no reason to recreate perfection. He's already sitting in perfection and he won't be recreated. When it says new heavens and new earth, we're talking about a new atmosphere, no longer polluted. As we know, the earth and the heavens are running down. The planet and its surrounding atmosphere all need to be reformed, remade, because since the day that sin was found in Adam, thorns and thistles grew up in the ground. You saw the beginning of the choking off of the natural vegetation that the folks could eat. You see Adam having to work by the sweat of his brow to find food again and to work to provide for he and his family. For those of you who have to go to work every day, that's Adam's fault. The world will be recreated, and as you read in Revelation 21 and 22 what it's going to look like, there's going to be plentiful food. Men are going to find perfection, long life. They're going to endure perfectly in God's presence. That is a new heaven and a new earth, but it's not the heaven where God sits. Verse 2 says, "And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." Now, there are very specific directional words in that verse. It does not say that New Jerusalem rises up to the heavens where God sits, which is the very common amillennial thinking about what the kingdom to come is going to be. I continue to contend that The kingdom to come is an earthly kingdom, just like all the kingdoms Daniel saw, physical earthly kingdoms that will be followed up by the kingdom when Christ returns to planet Earth to set up his kingdom. Look at the language here. It says, I see New Jerusalem coming down from God. So what direction is it moving? It's moving down from the heavens where God sits, and where is it moving down toward? Earth. So where is this kingdom going to be? Earth. Is that hard? Is that difficult? I mean, to me, that just seems so obvious. Verse 3, I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. Now, does that seem obvious as well? It doesn't say, behold, men have gone to the tabernacle of God. Rather, the tabernacle of God has come down to men, down to earth. And he, God, will dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. All of that language bespeaks God coming to earth, God coming to man, God bringing his tabernacle to men, as opposed to language that says men rise up to meet God, that men go to the tabernacle of God, that they go to join him. The language here is all God coming to join men. It's all earthly, physical language. Look at verse 4, though. Here are the attributes, the emotional attributes, the redemptive attributes that will come when this kingdom comes. Look at verse 4. God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. There shall be no more death, neither sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. Here's a simple test for you. There are folks who say that when Jesus spoke of a kingdom to come, or when John wrote this, 92 to 96 AD, that the kingdom had in some real, genuine sense had already come. You get the debate? The debate is, I'm a futurist. I believe there is a physical, literal kingdom coming to earth when Jesus comes back. But there are those who say there is a spiritual kingdom already operating and working among men, and that that fulfills all of the kingdom promises of the Old Testament. If that's true, then we ought to be able to find all the attributes of the kingdom already present and at work in his kingdom. Correct? Does that make sense? Did I lose anybody? Okay. Anybody here lately cried about anything? Pain? Anybody doing pain lately?
Ouch.
Ouch. Tom went to the hospital this week. Back pain problems. Pain. How about death? Anybody dying lately? Marcos just lost his aunt. Death is still at work. Is God dwelling with us presently, physically with us, where we can go to his tabernacle and be at the tabernacle of God? Well, no. See, if those attributes aren't active right now in the lives of men and women of God, then in fact that kingdom hasn't come. Does that seem obvious enough? Now, by the way, when we talk about the redemptive work of Christ and we talk about the kingdom to come, the things that seem to be emphasized most of the time from most churches and most pulpits is that there will be no more sin, and we like that. Good, sin, wrapped up in Christ, no more sin. Good, no more sin, we like that. No more death. Okay, heaven is going to be no death, no sin. Good. But look at the other attribute that's really emphasized here. No more pain, no more sorrow, no more crying. So then it seems to me that God understands the human life and Christian life contains sorrow and pain and crying. That's just part of life. It's part of this earthly journey, and it's part of the journey that God will wrap up, and wrap up so completely that God himself wipes away every tear. Don't you look forward to that? Because I've cried enough tears for one lifetime. I look forward to that time when God wipes away every tear. That's such a tender phrase, that God himself wipes away every tear. I saw a woman the other day on one of the religious TV shows, and a beautiful woman, beautiful hair, beautiful clothes. And she was talking about how she's had no trouble in her life, which I found just remarkable. And she continued to call her life the blessed life because she'd had, she said, no pain or sorrow or trouble in her life, so she had had a blessed life. As though blessing is now defined by no trouble, no sorrow, no problems. That's the blessed life. except that the Bible is absolutely chock full of people who have pain, sorrow, trouble, crying. Look at Paul's list of the things he'd been through. 5 times beaten with 39 lashes, beaten with rods, stoned and left for dead, a day and the night in the deep, in trouble in cities, in trouble out in the wilderness, jumped on by robbers, everywhere the man went, everything the man did, he was in trouble, and he was writing that from a prison in Rome. He's in a hole in Rome writing that he had discovered in whatever state he was in to be content. To find contentment in God, to find contentment in knowing that Jesus had said, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you, knowing that he was going to rise to the better resurrection. In that he could find contentment despite all the trouble of his life. He wrote 2/3 of the New Testament. Would you say he was blessed? He walked and talked with Jesus. Jesus taught him privately for 3 years in the desert. That's a blessed life. He was on a donkey on his way to go kill Christians when a light shined down and called him by name. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And it wasn't by his choice and it wasn't by his will, because the next thing he said was, who are you, Lord? He didn't know Jesus and he wasn't looking for Jesus and he was killing Christians. But Jesus came to him and saved him, causing him to write more than any other New Testament writer about the electing sovereign grace of God and the absolute willing love of God to do what he wanted and save his people. That was a blessed man. And yet he could write about his pain and his trouble and his beatings and his stonings and his imprisonments and his hungers and his fastings, and he was blessed. See, in God's way of thinking, and we're going to see it in a minute when we start talking about manna. Okay, half hour. You're going to see it in a half hour when we get talking about manna. That God was even willing with the children of Israel to make them hungry on purpose. That God dragged them out into the wilderness and then caused there to be no food for them on purpose. And they murmured and they cried and they came to Moses and they said, don't you care that we're starving? We want to go back to Egypt. Like Egypt was so good. We want to go back where we could sit by the flesh pots and there were plenty of onions and leeks to eat. We had plenty. We want to go back. The book of Nehemiah says that God did that on purpose. He suffered them to hunger on purpose because that served his purpose of making them appreciate the provision of God when he brought them food every day. You know, there's all sorts of philosophies out there that say you can't appreciate light without darkness. Oh, there's the, I thought it was going to be lighter. You can't appreciate, okay, then it was a illustration. You can't appreciate light without darkness. Is that one? There are philosophies out there that say you can't understand and you can't appreciate light without darkness. You can't appreciate comfort without pain. You can't appreciate food without hunger. You can't appreciate happiness without the sorrow that goes with it. And that is very much a biblical concept. You can't understand the joy of the Lord, and you can't understand and appreciate his willingness to wipe away your tears until you've cried enough tears to recognize and value the comfort of God. That's part of his plan. Life is hard. And I wanted so badly to tell that pretty woman on TV, I wanted to say to her, if you think your life is blessed because you haven't had any trouble or pain yet, you're young. Wait. Live a while. You're going to lose somebody you love. You're going to grieve. You're going to cry. Pain's coming. Sickness is coming. Death is coming. Death has a perfect record so far. The ratio on death is 1 for 1. Everybody gets one. You're going to have your opportunity because real Christianity, genuine Christianity, admits that pain and sorrow and trouble are just part of the journey. The book of James opens. He doesn't get past his first sentence before he says, brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations, trials, difficulty in this life. Count it all joy. How can you count it joy when you go through trials and pain? It's because you know that the servants know better than his master and that the master suffered. Jeff's reading through Hebrews for us now on Sunday mornings. He's going to read the passage that says that God, in order to bring many brethren to salvation, made the captain of their salvation, Christ, perfect through suffering. Isn't that amazing? God made Christ perfect through suffering. And then you've got that same Christ saying, if you were of the world would love its own. But you're not of the world, because I have chosen you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. If you were of the world, you know, the world, oh, the world loves the world. But if Jesus Christ has chosen you out of the mass of humanity and is drawing you to himself and revealing the Father to you, then the world will naturally not like you because you convict the world of its sin. You show that there is such a thing as faith and there is such a thing as God and there is such a thing as salvation and there is genuine Christianity in the world, and the world hates that because that convicts them of their sinfulness and their darkness. That's why the book of John would start right out, the Gospel of John would start right out by saying the light came into the world, into the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. The darkness hates the light because the light reproves the darkness of its sin. And so the world will make you suffer because the world hates you. And the world will laugh and enjoy it when you suffer. But Paul suffered and James suffered. The first century church suffered. Everybody who wrote that, that's what amazes me about, oh, now I'm getting revved. It's too early to get revved up. But this is what amazes me about the health, wealth, prosperity doctrine, is that if it were truly biblical, you would think you would find it somewhere in the Bible. And yet, every single person who wrote a word of the New Testament, check me out on it, every single person who wrote a word of the New Testament suffered. And not a one of them managed to achieve health, wealth, and prosperity in their life. You would think if they were the originators of the health, wealth, prosperity doctrine, at least one of them would have managed to do it. None. Not a one. They all suffered. They died martyrs' deaths. Dipped in oil. Lit in Nero's gardens to light his way when he walked at night. Read Hebrews 11. Jeff's going to for us in a few weeks. People driven through with swords and staves and, by best estimates, Thomas had his skin flayed off, driven through with Brahmin swords, driven through with spears. I mean, the people who wrote this Bible suffered and died for the testimony of Christ. And yet people who profess Christ now say, the blessed life is no suffering, no trial, no difficulty. You're wrong. Real, genuine Christianity has suffering and trial, temptations, difficulties. That's why Paul would write to the Corinthians and say, there is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not tempt you above that which you are able, but will, with the temptation, provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. That's good news. But inherent in that passage, in that verse, is you will suffer trials, temptations, problems. You're going to cry. You're going to hurt, there's going to be pain, there's going to be suffering. Because when God comes, he's going to wipe away every tear from our eyes. Won't that be wonderful when God says, you know what? That's enough. That's enough. Come on home, son. Come on home, daughter. That's enough. God will wipe away all the tears from their eyes. There will be no more death. Neither sorrow, neither crying, neither shall there be any more pain for the former things. Look at the former things. What are the former things? Crying, death, sorrow, pain, the former things. What happens to them? When the new Jerusalem comes, the new heaven, the new earth, the kingdom is established, Christ, the Prince of Peace, lives among his people, what will happen? The former things are passed away. Man, I like that. That whole new body thing, that sounds really attractive to me. Hair. And he that sat on the throne said, behold. Why are all those former things passed away? Because he that sits on the throne says, behold, I make all things new. Now what's the all things there? The heavens, the earth, and the way people live. They're all passed away. That's why Paul would write that the whole creation itself groans within itself, waiting for that day of restoration, of redemption, when the whole planet, the heavens, the earth, and the humans who abide on earth are all changed. And God says, I make all things new. And then he said to John, write these words because they're true and they're faithful. Which means that's all coming, friends. That's all coming. What a happy day that will be. If you think we sing happy now, And by the way, we're singing pretty happy these days. Jolene's doing a great job with the singing.
It's all Charlie.
And Charlie. But boy, we'll be doing some singing there, singing the song of the redeemed. Won't that be wonderful? What have you got, Jeff? You had something for
me. It was right before what you were quoting there in Romans 8 about the creation growing. He said that the Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed, and this is a strong emphatic in Greek, if indeed we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him.
So what is the purpose of the suffering with him?
To be glorified
with him.
Then he immediately says,
you can see the equation.
Are not to be compared.
Say it again.
Immediately he says, you know, he considers the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is revealed in us.
No, absolutely not. The glory that's going to be revealed in us is such that the suffering we're going through now can't even compare. And if you can keep that mindset, if you can keep a hold of that, you can endure, as I've recently discovered, you can endure the impossible. You can endure things you never thought you could endure if you can keep that mindset. Let me go even further, as long as we're here for a second, because I just made a mistake. I'm going to point out my own mistake. I said you can endure those things if you can keep that mindset. The truth is, when you're enduring those things, especially when you're enduring the impossible, you can't keep that mindset. I was talking to a pastor friend of mine, and he was saying all the right things. He was saying wonderfully good things and encouraging me and saying, you know, Jim, you have to look to Christ, and you have to look to him as the rock of your defense, and you have to look to him, and you need to hold on to him to get through these kind of times and these kind of troubles, and hold on to him. And I had to explain to him that I couldn't. I said, you know, if it had been left up to me to hold on and endure, I'm a dead man, because I couldn't do it. It was too dark. It was too hard. I was crying too much. It was too difficult for me to hold on. But you know what? I endured because he is faithful. And that those principles work not because we're strong enough to hang on to him, but because he is ever faithful to hold on to us. And he held on to me when it was impossible for me to hold on to him. When I couldn't see past my own flesh and my own pain and my own darkness, he held on to me because he's faithful and these principles work. Everything I've ever told you about the faithfulness of God to his word, to himself, and most importantly, to his people, is true. It's absolutely true. Because he will get you through times of trouble and pain and sorrow for his own glory. So that you will appreciate when he wipes away every tear. When there's no more sorrow and no more pain, you won't know how great that is unless you've had some sorrow and pain and tears. And I've had my share. But he took me through it. And he's continuing to take me through it. And I have every confidence now that he will continue to take me through it because he's already shown me his faithfulness. So that I rest on. I rest on his faithfulness even when I know that I'm faithless. I trust his endurance when I can't endure anymore. You get me? To use the colloquial, are you feeling me? Okay. All right. I promised you we would talk this morning about the phrase. By the way, that was all introduction. Does not technically count against my time. Good, you know the rules. As you're going through the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, which art in heaven, holy or hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. The next phrase is, give us this day our daily bread. The word day shows up twice in that short passage. The daily provision of God, and you'll notice that in that prayer it does not anywhere say, and provide for me tomorrow's bread, and next week's bread, and it would be nice if I had next month's bread, then I would feel really secure. Rather, what you're allowed to pray to God, according to Jesus' model of prayer, is, provide for me today the food I need for today. There's no promise in there about tomorrow. You don't know if you'll be here tomorrow. None of us knows if we'll be here tomorrow. Nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. But God knows what's going to happen tomorrow, and he absolutely insists that you trust him day in, day out, each individual day. Trust him for today, which, by the way, is a very healthy way to live psychologically. I had a professor in California who used to say, no one ever had a nervous breakdown worrying about today. That's true. We go nuts worrying about tomorrow, next week. Oh, gee, next month. What about my bills a year from now? That'll drive you crazy. You can stay up all night worrying about that. But today, today's covered. You got today covered. There's not a person in the room who doesn't believe they're going to make it through today. Tomorrow, maybe not, but today I feel pretty good about. You know where today's bread is. Today's bread is probably at home in your refrigerator. If not, you've got enough money in your wallet to drive through McDonald's and get today's bread. You're going to get your food for today. You feel good about today, but you'll worry about tomorrow. What about tomorrow? Oh, what about tomorrow? I get children to feed. I've got bills to pay. I've got responsibilities to take care of. Those are the ones that scare us to death. But the truth is, you have no promise from God beyond today. And that ought to be enough for you. Knowing full well that tomorrow, when it gets here, will be today. And you can go to him and say again, give me today my daily bread. I think sometimes, because we're so blessed to the point of being spoiled, because we have such an overabundance of things, that we have really lost that first century mindset where all the Old and New Testament talks about food and raiment. I preached about this a lot when we were working our way through the book of Philippians. But the only promise you have, and check me out on it, the only promise you have in the Bible from God is food and raiment. Food and raiment, over and over again, food and raiment. Having food and raiment, Paul would argue, therewith be content. Food and raiment, that's all you're promised. When Jesus talks about, behold, the lilies of the field, Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed as one of these, but if God would clothe the grass, which today is, and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, won't he also clothe you? And then he says, behold, you know, the birds in the sky, your Father feeds them. If he'll feed the birds, won't he much more care about you and feed you? Food and raiment, that's all he discusses. He doesn't talk about a place to live. We all have places to live. We have roofs over our heads and air conditioning and central heating. When someone said to Jesus, I'll follow you wherever you go, he said, foxes have dens, birds have nests, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Food and raiment, that's what you're promised in the Bible. And we've lost that because we have so much food. Highest quality food in the history of the world is available to us at drive-through convenience now. More food than any society in the history of the world has had. We have access to it. And most of us are trying to lose a few pounds. Too much food. And raiment, forget about it. Raiment, we got so much raiment. There's not a person here that doesn't have a closet full of clothes. So much food and clothing that I think we've forgotten how to depend on God on a day-to-day basis. But if you were part of that sort of nomadic, desert-dwelling, Middle Eastern, gotta find food and water every day, if that was your existence, then you got up every day recognizing that you had to find food today because you don't have refrigerators, you don't have ways to keep food fresh. Maybe you could salt it and keep it for a couple of days, but boy, you got to every day get out there and find yourself something to wear and something to eat. That was life every day. Most folks had one cloak, and even the law of Moses said, because the cloak was so important, it kept you the sun off you during the day, and it kept you warm during the night in those desert temperatures. Even the law says that if you took a man's cloak as surety for a loan, you had to give it back to him by nightfall. That's how important a cloak was. So if you had something to eat and something to wear each day, God was providing for you. And you had that sense every day of, oh, good, food. Oh, I have something to eat. God has provided for me. But now we don't even think about God's provision because Kroger's provides for us. And Food Lion provides. And we go to work every day thinking, well, I went to work. I got my money. I ran down to the Food Lion. I bought myself some food. I did this. And you lose the sense that God did this. Because it was God who gave you the strength to go to work, to make the money, to buy the stuff. It's God who made you wake up this morning and know your own name. It's God who gives you the breath that's in your nostrils. And by the way, you're only one nostril full of air away from dead. And it's God who provides every day, over and over, keeps you alive, keeps you going, keeps you strong, keeps providing. And we forget. It's so easy. How many times this week did you sit down and eat and forget to say thank you? Lots of times, huh? Because it comes so fast. It's everywhere. There's food everywhere. Driving down the road, I feel hungry. I need a Whopper. 10 minutes later, you're eating a Whopper. I mean, how spoiled are we? And we'll forget to say thanks. Well, I was driving and talking on the phone and eating my Whopper. I didn't have time to thank God. You should thank him. Oh, I'm sorry. Did that hit home with the back row? I'm sorry. We are so genuinely spoiled that we have lost that sense of daily bread. Well, I say all that to say, when Jesus used the phrase, give us today our daily bread, it was very specific to a Jewish people who understood their long history of daily bread, their forefathers, their progenitors that had brought them into the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, the very place Jesus was now walking and talking. Their forefathers ate for 40 years every day bread that was provided for them from heaven every single day. So we're going to look at that to start today, and then it'll probably take us into next week to see how Jesus applied the daily bread concept to himself. And there's a couple of extra rabbit trails we're going to chase in there along the way. So we've got our work cut out for us. Let's start at Exodus 16. Exodus 16 is the introduction of manna in the Old Testament. We mentioned it last week, so you should all know. What does the word manna mean? It means, what is it? Isn't that funny? I find it funny because Christians have a tendency to kind of create their own lexicon. The church has its own language that it uses, which I think kind of drives a wedge between the world and the church even further, because we use a lot of language that people can't possibly understand. And then we take words that are very common and we make them, we sort of glorify them and put them up on a pinnacle. And manna is one of those words where people speak of manna like, oh, manna. It means, what is it? You never hear anybody go, oh, what is it? There are several ministries I can think of that use the word manna in their name, which I just find very funny because of what the word means. The ministry of what is it? And most of them, if you listen for a while, well, never mind. Chapter 16 says, and they, this is all Israel, traveling out of Egypt, following Moses, they took their journey from Elam, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came unto the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. So they are now roughly a month and a half out of Egypt. They're halfway through their second month out of Egypt. And they're traveling, he's very specifically saying, they're going through a wilderness area, the wilderness of Sin, which is by Sinai, which is a desert. Not a lot of food. Not a lot of water available in that area. Verse 2, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, like it's Moses' fault. They're wandering now in the wilderness for a month and a half. They're starting to get hungry, and they're getting upset about it. So what do? Complain, because that's what we human beings do. Verse 3, and the children of Israel said unto them, unto Moses and Aaron, would to God we had died at the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. Isn't that amazing? God has just shown his hand in mighty, miraculous ways that you and I have never seen. I have often contended, you show me one good Red Sea parting, you don't have to worry about my faith for the rest of my life. I'm going to be pretty solid on that. Forget Red Sea. A pond, I'm going to be impressed. These folks walked through the Red Sea when it was parted. They walked on dry ground. The pillar of God came down and separated them from their enemies. Light to their side, darkness to their enemy's side. The enemies go down to follow them into the Red Sea. The water collapses on them and kills their enemies, who, by the way, were not just their captors. But before they left Egypt, God showed favor to the Israelites so that the Egyptians gave them all their gold and gave them their cattle and gave them all their jewelry. So God drowned their debtors. He gave them all the wealth of Egypt. They left with the wealth of Egypt, and then God drowned the people they owed it to. That's pretty impressive. They're a month and a half into it and have decided God can't provide, and said it would have been better if we had just died in Egypt. It's amazing.
Doesn't sound too far from what we do, though.
No, it doesn't. No, but you're absolutely right. When was the last time any of you asked the question, why me? Yeah. Why me? I thought you liked me, God. Everything was going along pretty well. Why me? You know what the answer is to that? Why not you? Yeah, what made you special? Yeah, you're a sinner like the rest of us. And if you're a Christian like the rest of us, suffering, pain, sorrow, part of the journey. Why not you? So they said, would to God we had died in the land of Egypt. We had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. Isn't that amazing? We would have rather that God just killed us in Egypt than brought us out here. They recognize the hand of God. They see the sovereignty of God in bringing them out there, and they're still not content with it. It's amazing. When we sat by the flesh pots and we did eat bread to the full. Do you hear what they're complaining about? Their flesh, their bellies. We're hungry, so we're not happy anymore. Sure, that whole Red Sea thing, that was impressive, but that was a month and a half ago. What have you done for me lately? I'm hungry now. As if God couldn't provide. I did the Red Sea thing. You think I don't know you're hungry? And as I said, when we get to Nehemiah's telling of this, Nehemiah is going to say that God specifically made them hungry. God did it on purpose. He knew what he was doing. We ate bread to the full. For you, Moses and Aaron, you've brought us forth into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. There's an accusation. You brought us out here specifically to kill us, didn't you? Like Moses would go, you caught on. That was my plan all along. Get you out of Egypt, Red Sea thing, bring you out here and kill you. That was always the plan. Ha! You caught on. Verse 4. Then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. The people shall go out and gather a certain rate of bread every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. Now look at what he's doing. He says, I will every single day rain down bread from heaven, miraculous food for them to eat every day. Every day. And they still won't walk in my statutes. They're out here saying, oh, God should have killed us in Egypt. You brought us out here to kill us. And God says, you know what? If that's your complaint, you need fleshly provision. I'm going to provide all this fleshly provision for you to prove to you that you still won't walk by my law. And you know what? God's right. They don't do it. Even though he provides for them everything they want, they still don't do it. Boy, do I have to convince anybody here that men are sinners? And women too? Don't. Men and women are sinners. We have so much more than these people had. They got daily bread. 40 years of daily bread. And they still end up rebelling against God. We have so much bread, we have so much raiment, we have places to live, and we will still rebel against him. We will still not walk by his statutes. We'll still go our own way. We'll still wander off like sheep. We still want what we want when we want it. Isn't that indicative of our sinful nature? Boy, it's a good thing we have a Savior that saves to the uttermost. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain down from heaven for you and for the people. They'll go out and they'll gather a certain rate every day, and I will prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it'll be twice as much as they gather daily. Now, here's what he's doing. He's telling them that they have to keep his law. Part of the law is keeping the Sabbath. Every seventh day, they're not allowed to do any servile work. So God says every day they're going to go out and they're going to collect manna. However, on the sixth day, they're supposed to go out and collect twice as much manna so that on the seventh day, there's no gathering. And for 40 long years, God never misses a Sabbath. And for 40 long years, every seventh day, there's no manna on the ground. 6 days out of every week, plenty of manna. And it turns out that if you, on any day, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, if you go out and you collect more than you need, the next day it's full of worms and it stinks and you want it out of your house. But anything you collect on Friday and keep till Saturday stays clean, stays good the next day. How miraculous is this bread? This is a bread that keeps a calendar. This is a bread that stinks Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, if you keep it. But if you collect it on Friday and keep it till Saturday, it's perfectly good the next day. Keeping is Sabbath. So, Moses and Aaron, verse 6, said unto all the children of Israel, in the evening, then you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning, then you shall see the glory of the Lord, for that he heard your murmurings against the Lord, and you will understand what are we that you're murmuring against us. In other words, he's saying, tonight you're going to understand that God brought you out of Egypt. And in the morning, you're going to see a miracle that is going to convince you that not only did he bring you out of Egypt, but he's still with you. And it's going to convict you that you murmured not against me and Aaron, not against Moses and Aaron, but when you murmured and complained against us, you were complaining against the Lord. And the Lord heard your murmuring and your complaining and is now going to provide for you. They think it's a blessing, when in fact it's going to serve to condemn and convict them. And every one of the first generation of Israel is going to die in the wilderness with daily bread provided for them, because it's going to serve to convict them of their sinfulness. This is heavy stuff, this daily bread stuff. Verse 8, and Moses said, this shall be, when the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, for that the Lord hears your murmuring which you murmur against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us. Your murmurings are against the Lord. And Moses spoke unto Aaron and said, say to all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your complaining. Do you think God still hears us when we complain? Could he be happy about that? I mean, look, these people are in a desert and they are hungry. They're legitimately hungry. There's a lack of water, and they're in a desert. That seems like a good reason to complain, actually, doesn't it? Month and a half short on food. You've got one pair of sandals. You've got one set of clothing. You're walking in a hot desert. There's no water, and there's no food. Now look at you. We got nice clothes. We got nice places to live. We drive air-conditioned cars. We got refrigerators full of food. We got closets full of clothes. And I guarantee you complained this week. Didn't you? Complained about something, murmured about something. I'm not happy. This is not going well for me. I've got problems. This is, oh, but did your mother just eye you in the middle of that? Yes, she did. Oh, wow. This is not good for me. Look, God hears it. God knows. And he knows what he's provided for you. And he knows how much you have. And he knows his hand of blessing. And he knows his word of promise. And he knows he said, be content with such things as you have. For I have said, I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. Which ought to be good enough for you. It ought to be adequate. Here he is telling the children of Israel, I have not left you. I have not forsaken you. I brought you through the Red Sea. I've brought you out here into the wilderness. And now just because you're hungry, all of a sudden you think, oh, God should have killed us. Okay, now I'm going to bring you bread. But I'm telling you, I'm going to fill your belly. And you're all going to die in the wilderness because you're complaining and not keeping the law, not following after my word. And Moses said to Aaron, verse 9, say unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmuring. And it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, I have heard the murmuring of the children of Israel. Speak unto them, saying, at evening you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God. God was going to prove it by filling their bellies yet again. And every one of us has full bellies, right? Some of us too full. Some of us trying to scale down on the belly a little bit. I didn't look your way. I wasn't looking at anyone in particular. Verse 13, and it came to pass that at evening the quails came up and they covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host. So that night God brings in enough quail. Now you're talking about, there's different estimates, anywhere between 1 and 3 million people. How many quail is it going to take to satisfy that many people? That's a bunch of quail. That night, God brings in enough birds for everybody to eat. And the next morning, enough manna on the ground for everybody to collect enough to feed their family. This is unbelievable provision. Verse 14, and when the dew was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness. The face of the wilderness. This is not good ground where fruit grows. Out there on the face of the wilderness, behold, there lay a small round thing, as small as the white frost that was on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it is manna, for they did not know what it was. In other words, you can translate that, like I said, they said to each other, what is it? Because they didn't know what it was. And Moses said unto them, this is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man according to his eating, an omer for every man according to the number of your persons. Take you every man for them which are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so, and they gathered. Some gathered more, some gathered less, according to how many they had. And when they did measure it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing left over, and he that gathered little had no lack. And they gathered every man according to his eating. And Moses said, let no man leave any of it until the morning. Notwithstanding, they didn't listen to Moses, but some of them left some of it until the morning, and it bred worms, and it stunk. And Moses was very angry with them because they didn't do what they were told. Again, this seems so obvious to me. You know, if you're hungry and you're starving and you're in the desert, and God provides for you food and says, now here's the way to do it, you do it that way. But of course, human beings, sinners go, well, sure, everybody else is just taking today's. I'll get a little for tomorrow, a little for me. Forget the other 3 million of you. A little extra for me. The next day it stinks, it's full of worms. And of course, Moses is angry because the first day that God provides for them, they're already not doing it God's way.
Well, we think we can do it better.
We can do it better. I have a better idea. I have a better plan. Sure, God's word says this. I have a better idea. Verse 21. And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating, and when the sun waxed hot, the manna melted. And it came to pass that on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for one man. And all of the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses, and he said, this is that which the Lord has said. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. So bake that which you will bake today, seethe that which you will seethe, or boil what you will boil today, and that which remains over, lay up to be kept until the morning. And they laid it up until the morning, as Moses had told them, and it did not stink, neither were there any worms in it. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is the Sabbath unto the Lord. Today you shall not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, and on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there won't be any. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day to gather, and they didn't find any. Yeah, because they were breaking the Sabbath. Rather than resting in their homes, they went out to gather. There's none out there. Do it God's way. The rules are pretty simple. Verse 27, and it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day to gather, and there wasn't any. Verse 28, and the Lord said unto Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? He's already taken them to Sinai. He's already given them the law. They've already been told every seventh day you rest. The very first Sabbath, they break the Sabbath to go look for the bread. I got to go get my bread today. If I don't get my bread today, I mean, what'll happen? I'll get hungry again. I was hungry just a week ago when God provided the bread and the quail in the first place. But I'll be hungry again. I'll go and get me some. Do you see the way humans work? God, of course, says, how long will you not do it my way? Verse 29. See, for that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide you every man in that place, and let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. And the house of Israel called the name of that place manna. And the manna looked like coriander seed. It was white. And to taste it was like wafers made of honey. And Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord commands. Fill an omer of it, to be kept throughout all your generations, that they may see the bread wherewith I have fed you in the wilderness when I brought you forth out of the land of Egypt. Now, again, this is even more amazing. Now Moses commands the people and says, now take some of this manna and keep it for all your generations. Which means if Tim goes out and gathers some on a Wednesday and takes it into the house and doesn't eat it, on Thursday it's full of worms and it stinks. But if Tim goes out on Friday and picks up twice as much, on Saturday it's still good. But when the people take some of that same bread as a memorial, it lasts into the generations so that they can show future generations the bread that they ate. Do you see how miraculous this bread is?
Do they still have it?
No, and I'll tell you why. In the Ark of the Covenant, the square gold box that was kept in the tabernacle, the place where the glory of God would come down once a year on the Day of Atonement and land on the covering, the Kapparath, the mercy seat where the two angels were, inside the Ark of the Covenant there were three things. Do you remember what the three things were that were in it? There was manna in a golden cup inside the Ark of the Covenant, that very manna that they were told to keep through the generations. What were the other two things, as long as we're here? Aaron's rod that budded, a sign of resurrection and new life. And the second set of the Ten Commandments. Very good, she got it right. It's the second set of the Ten Commandments. Any of you who have ever watched Raiders of the Lost Ark, they said that it was the first set of the Ten Commandments. Got that one completely wrong. Moses broke the first one because the first law was broken. The second law was kept perfectly in Christ, and that was kept inside the Ark of the Covenant, as was the rod that budded, the sign of resurrection, new life, and the manna, which Jesus is going to say, and we'll probably get to it next week. It's in the book of Luke when he says, I am that bread from heaven, making himself the fulfillment of the type of the manna in the wilderness. So all of those things that are in the ark speak of Christ in his resurrection, in his bread from heaven, in his kept law, but they also speak of the triunity of God, the law of God, the resurrection of the Holy Spirit, and the bread from heaven, Christ. So inside that box, there's all this great symbology. So you ask, do we still have it? No, because the Ark of the Covenant, during the time of Jeremiah, with all the other furniture, was taken and hidden and hasn't been found since. So now if we find the Ark of the Covenant... Moses said, I'm nearly done here. Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord commands, fill an omer of it to be kept for the generations, that they may see the bread wherewith I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you forth out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said unto Aaron, take a pot and put an omer full of manna therein and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations. And the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony. What is the testimony there? The tablets of stone, the tablets that Moses came down with, the second tablets, they brought down this omer of manna and laid it there with the law of God. Now, how important is that manna when it's being laid with the only other precious item they have in the wilderness? These stones that were cut out by Moses and then written with the finger of God, the law of God written on it, and the only other thing that could be close to those stones was the manna laid up in front of it. Very, very important to God. And the children of Israel did eat manna for 40 years until they came to a land inhabited. And they did eat manna until they came unto the borders of the land of Canaan. And then he says an omer is a tenth part of an ephah. For those of you who are measuring, get yourself an ephah. A tenth part would be an omer. Does that help? So the point is for this morning, from there we're going to go into Numbers 11 next week. And you're going to see that not only did God provide for them every day, day in and day out, this bread from heaven to eat, but do you know that these folks actually got so used to, so accustomed to the provision of God that they actually reached the point where they go to Moses and they say, our soul hates this light bread. We've been provided for 40 years. And Moses is going to point out, you know, the leather in your shoes hasn't worn out. And the fabric of your cloth, of your clothes, has not worn out. And you have eaten bread from heaven every day for 40 years while you've wandered in the wilderness, and God has been faithful every single day to bring you your bread, and you have the nerve to come in here and say, you know, I'm really, really tired of God's provision. Heavy words, they said, my soul loathes this light bread. So God is going to respond to them in their complaining and in their loathing, by one more time giving them what they want. And there's an object lesson there, I think, for all of us. Be careful that what you want is also what God wants for you, because God is perfectly willing sometimes to give you what you want to teach you. There are plenty of people in the room nodding and going, yes, I get the whole what I want thing. Yeah, what you want and what God wants for you are two completely different things. Learn to be content with what God wants for you. So that's where we'll pick up next week in Numbers 11. And we'll get into the fiery serpents. And believe it or not, the fiery serpents are going to take us to John 3:16. There's so much going on here with the manna that it'll take us a few weeks to get through it. All right? We'll just call that introduction to manna. Any questions? All right, good. You folks will just have to drive back from Memphis next week or you'll be completely left out.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.